As the U.S. continues to occupy parts of Syria in a clear violation of the territorial integrity of the Arab country, an Apache attack helicopter belonging to the U.S. military has reportedly crashed in Syria's northeastern province of Hasakeh, with no information available about the fate of those on board the helicopter. The initial deployment of U.S. occupation soldiers to that specific area was meant to plunder the country's crude oil resources. However, now it seems someone is making sure that the U.S. abandons their theft efforts. U.S. Apache down in Syria in this following report.
A Boeing AH-64 Apache attack helicopter belonging to the U.S. military reportedly crashed on the morning of Tuesday, January 19, in Syria's northeastern province of Hasakeh, with no information available about the fate of those on board. The Arabic service of Russia's Sputnik News Agency, citing local sources, reported that the aircraft went down inside a U.S.-run base at the Al-Jabsa oil field in the oil-rich city of Al-Shaddadi, located about 60 kilometers south of the provincial capital city of Hasakeh. The sources claim the helicopter crashed during a refueling operation and that there were reports of injuries among its crew members. The U.S. military has stationed forces and equipment in northeastern Syria, with the Pentagon claiming that the deployment is aimed at preventing the oil fields in the area from falling into the hands of Daesh terrorists. Damascus, however, says the deployment is meant to plunder the country's resources. The U.S. first confirmed its looting of Syrian oil during a Senate hearing exchange between South Carolina Republican Senator Lindsey Graham and U.S. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo in late July last year. On July 30, and during his testimony to the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, Pompeo confirmed for the first time that an American oil company would begin work in northeastern Syria, which is controlled by Kurdish militants from the so-called Syrian Democratic Forces, SDF. The Syrian government strongly condemned the agreement, saying that the deal was struck to plunder the country's natural resources, including oil and gas, under the sponsorship and support of the administration of U.S. President Donald Trump. Separately, the U.S. military reportedly transported dozens of Daesh terrorists from prisons run by allied Kurdish militants in northeastern Syria to Al Tanf military base in southern Syria near the Jordanian border. That is the same Tanf area that Israel and the U.S. usually target to stop the advancement of the Syrian Arab Army, the only legitimate force that actually eliminated Daesh in more than 70% of Syria.
Now, with us from Damascus is Vanessa Bealey, independent journalist, to talk to us about what is happening inside Syria, the occupied territories of Syria by the U.S. occupation. Thank you for being with us, Vanessa. Now, when a U.S. Apache helicopter is said to have crashed in Syria's northeastern province of Hasakeh near the Al-Jabsa oil field, where U.S. occupation forces have been plundering Syrian crude oil, would that still make it an accident?
Well, as far as I know, we don't have any update on the reasons behind that crash, and I don't think there has been any official statement that I'm aware of either from Syrian military or from the Americans. So I think we have to assume for now that it was an accident until we hear otherwise, particularly from the Syrian military. If it was brought down by Syrian military, they are normally pretty quick to put out a statement taking responsibility, but we don't have any such statement.
Well, but that also means that someone, some group of some form from Hasakeh might actually be beginning some sort of a resistance against the occupiers. Could that be an actual scenario in the upcoming weeks?
It's very possible. We've seen quite a number of videos coming out of the region showing local and tribal members basically resisting the U.S. illegal occupation of that area. And of course, a recent, I think it was a Reuters or an AP photograph showing a local child sort of digging through the rubbish surrounding the oil fields, trying to find food to eat, while in the background, the Kurdish Contras, under the direction of the U.S. occupation, U.S. coalition occupation forces, are, as you say, plundering Syria of its oil resources via the Delta Crescent Energy Oil Company, which was allowed to enter Syria under the Trump administration.
Mm-hmm. Well, the U.S. occupation reportedly transported also dozens of Daesh terrorists from prisons run by their allied Kurdish contras in northeastern Syria to Al-Tanf military base in southern Syria, which is near the Jordanian border. Now, that is in that same area, the U.S. and Israel have been bombing any sort of advancement for the Syrian Arab Army or its allies. They are not allowing them to go and liberate the area. What is the U.S. planning to do with those terrorists in that specific area?
Well, that's a very good question. Of course, not only is the U.S. transporting ISIS fighters to Al-Tanf, but they are also transporting them across the border into Iraq, where they are being retrained and re-equipped into a kind of super ISIS, which is then being percolated back into northeastern Syria. And of course, recently we've seen a spate of attacks by ISIS against Syrian Arab Army convoys on the road to Deir ez-Zor, including one yesterday which left three Syrian Arab Army martyred and 10 wounded. Air cover was then given to the convoy, which allowed it to arrive safely at Deir ez-Zor. But in Al-Tanf itself, of course, we shouldn't forget that there is a 55-kilometer exclusion zone around Al-Tanf military base.
Mm-hmm.
The Al-Walid crossing into Iraq is what is being used to transport the stolen oil into Iraq for trading. And, of course, that trading revenue is sustaining the proxies on the ground inside Syria, previously ISIS and now, of course, the Kurdish contras. But also what is important to understand is that in that 55-kilometer exclusion zone around Al-Tanf, there are ongoing military exercises overseen by the U.S. occupation troops using equipment such as HIMARS, the High Mobility Artillery Units, that have a maximum range of 300 kilometers. This puts them with potential to target the outskirts of Damascus.
Wow.
So terrorists are being given equipment which can effectively be used against, as you rightly stated, Syrian Arab Army, Russian positions, allied positions, but can also be used to target civilian infrastructure in the future if there is an escalation, and we see very strong signs of an escalation under the Joe Biden administration.
Vanessa, what I want to talk about is that Syria has actually issued its first message to the new U.S. President Joe Biden, urging the incoming U.S. leader to withdraw troops from the war-torn nation and to abandon efforts to tap into the country's oil reserves. How do you think the new administration will receive that?
Well, I mean, I think it's very convenient that we've seen almost immediately surrounding Biden's inauguration, we saw an ISIS attack in Baghdad. We've seen, as I said, an increase in ISIS attacks on the ground in northeastern Syria and stretching towards northeastern Aleppo and towards Homs. And so, of course, if we remember back to 2018, December, when Trump said he was going to withdraw the troops, almost immediately there was an ISIS attack on Manbij, which killed four American operatives, potential intelligence operatives, and injured three others. And so, therefore, the plans to remove or withdraw troops were scotched. And now, of course, with the Biden incoming administration, and that administration consisting of, let's say, Bush, Obama, Clinton, era war hawks and neoconservatives, we know that there is very likely to be an increase of American military footprint in Syria. And we've seen that in the last few days. We've seen military convoys, U.S. military convoys, entering northeast Syria with hardware and weapons, heading for the region around the oil fields, which, of course, is occupied by U.S. coalition troops and proxies.
That raises a lot of flags, Vanessa, concerning that when you said in the Trump administration, when Trump wanted to remove the soldiers, the people who are controlling ISIS, which, as you said, are within the current administration and the former Obama administration, were actually sending messages against their own soldiers by targeting them to make them remain as an occupation inside Syria. That's a very dangerous issue. But yet again, Biden has not set any clear strategy for Syria, but his campaign has sought to distance itself from the Trump approach. Yet Biden also never commented on the continuous Israeli aggression against the Syrian Arab army, specifically lately against civilians in Hama. Do you think that Israel can still maintain an open aggressive policy against Syria now that Trump is no longer there?
Well, let's also not forget that the U.S. itself, I think it was just prior to the inauguration of Joe Biden, targeted Iraqi army positions inside Iraq and PMU positions. Mm-hmm. So it's clear that you know, what we're seeing since New Year's Eve, in reality, which I guess was kind of the handover period, the vacuum period between Trump leaving and Biden coming in, we've seen, as you said, an increase in Israeli attacks leading to, a couple of days ago, an attack at 4 a.m. in the morning, which targeted multiple areas in Syria, including, as you rightly say, a little village, Gazoo, to the west of Hama, where four civilian homes were destroyed and a family of four was martyred and tens of others were injured. I'll actually be visiting that area in the next few days.
We are out of time. I want to thank Vanessa Bealey, independent journalist, for joining us from Damascus to talk about the latest developments in the occupied territories by the U.S. occupation in Syria. Thank you, and please stay tuned next week for more from the Middle East Stream.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In mixed fortunes for Joe Biden's efforts to roll back Donald Trump's hardline immigration policies, the government rescinded the Trump-era zero-tolerance policy that resulted in thousands of families' separations at the U.S.-Mexico border, whilst in a federal court a judge blocked the new president's 100-day moratorium on deportations. The article you're about to hear has been taken from the Associated Press website. The piece is titled, Biden Rescinds Zero Tolerance Policy, but Judge Blocks Halt to Deportations. Stay with us for more of the article from the Associated Press. Mixed fortunes for Joe Biden's efforts to roll back Donald Trump's hardline immigration policies, the government rescinded the Trump-era zero-tolerance policy that resulted in thousands of family separations at the U.S.-Mexico border, whilst in a federal court, a judge blocked the new president's 100-day moratorium on deportations. Acting U.S. Attorney General Monty Wilkinson issued the new Department of Justice memo to federal prosecutors across the nation, saying the administration would return to its long-standing previous policy and instructing prosecutors to act on the merits of individual cases where migrants have crossed into the United States unlawfully. Acting Attorney General Monty Wilkinson said the department's principals have long emphasized that decisions about bringing criminal charges should involve not only a determination that a federal offense has been committed and that the admissible evidence will probably be sufficient to obtain and sustain a conviction, but should also take into account other individualized factors, including personal circumstances and criminal history, the seriousness of the offense, and the probable sentence or other consequences that would result from a conviction. The Trump administration's zero-tolerance policy meant that any adult caught crossing the United States border unlawfully would be prosecuted for illegal entry. Because children cannot be jailed with their family members, families were separated and children were put into different types of detention, with minors taken into custody by the Health and Human Services Department, which manages unaccompanied children at the U.S.-Mexico border. While the rescinding of zero tolerance is in part symbolic, it undoes the Trump administration's hugely unpopular policy responsible for the separation of more than 5,500 children and toddlers from their parents at the U.S.-Mexico border. Most families have not been prosecuted under the policy since 2018, when the separations were halted, though separations continued on a smaller scale. President Biden has issued an executive order to undo some of Donald Trump's restrictive policies, but the previous administration has so altered the immigration landscape that it will take quite a while to untangle all the major changes. Biden also wants to offer a path to legal status for an estimated 11 million undocumented immigrants living in the United States. Some of the parents separated from their children were deported. Advocates for the families have called on President Biden to allow those families to reunite in the United States. Trump's then Attorney General Jeff Sessions in 2018, along with Donald Trump himself and other top leaders in his administration, were bent on curbing immigration. The zero-tolerance policy was one of the several increasingly restrictive policies aimed at discouraging migrants from coming to the southern border of the United States. Donald Trump's administration also vastly reduced the number of refugees allowed into the United States and all but halted asylum at the border through a combination of executive orders and regulation changes. The policy was an absolute disaster. There was no system created to reunite children with their families, and some children are still separated many years later. A report from the Department of Justice's Inspector General, released earlier this month, found that the policy led to a $227 million funding shortfall. Children suffered lasting emotional damage from the separations, and the policy was criticized as grossly inhumane by world leaders. Meanwhile, a federal judge on Tuesday, 26th of January, barred the U.S. government from enforcing a 100-day deportation moratorium that is a key immigration priority of the new president, Joe Biden. U.S. District Judge Drew Tipton issued a temporary restraining order sought by Texas, which sued last Friday against the Department of Homeland Security memo that instructed immigration agencies to pause most deportations of immigrants. U.S. District Judge Drew Tipton said the Biden administration had failed to provide any concrete, reasonable justification for a 100-day pause on deportations. Joe Biden promised during his campaign to pause most deportations for 100 days. The order represents a victory for Texas's Republican leaders, who often sued to stop programs enacted by Biden's Democratic predecessor, Barack Obama. It also showed that just as Democratic-led states and immigration groups fought Donald Trump over immigration in courts of law, often successfully, so too were Republicans with Biden in office.
Around the World with Reporters.
The steadfastness of Yemen and the resistance of Palestinians is the slogan of a press conference held by the Yemen-Palestine Organization. Participants discussed Yemeni-Palestinian relations and their common vision, which is resistance against the Zionist projects in the region.
This event is a Yemeni-Palestinian initiative for political awakening and for the unity of both nations to achieve a common goal of defeating the Israeli regime's plans in the region and liberation of Palestine. Israel is our common enemy and the enemy of Muslim nations.
The participants affirmed that Yemen and Palestine have strong ties that transcend geographical borders, as Yemen has become an important part of the axis of resistance. The Yemen-Palestine Organization also revealed its humanitarian plan for 2021, which will contribute to alleviating the suffering of Yemenis due to the continuing war and the blockade imposed by the U.S.-backed Saudi-led coalition.
Yemenis believe that the U.S. as the main supporter of Israel is also responsible for the sufferings of Palestinians and Yemenis. They say resistance is the only way to achieve victory and liberation. Abdul Latif Al-Washali, Sana'a.
Almost 3 months have passed since the beginning of the intra-Afghan talks in Qatari capital Doha. The negotiating team of the Afghan government accuses the Taliban of foot-dragging, but the militant group rejects such allegation.
The negotiating team of the Islamic Republic of Afghanistan is fully ready for talks, but the Taliban side has ignored to attend the meetings over the past 10 days under the pretext of being busy with their own meetings.
In the meantime, this top army official, who usually spends much of his time in front lines, also accuses the Taliban of expanding their attacks amid condemnations by the Afghan people and international bodies like the United Nations. That is why officials here warn that Afghan troops may intensify their attacks on the Taliban if they continue targeting civilians.
Our message to the Taliban is to either grab the current opportunity to bring peace or stop targeting civilians. Otherwise, we will pound their positions across the country and we will kill them one by one.
Despite all ifs and buts regarding the Afghan peace process, what war-weary Afghans want is lasting peace and an opportunity to forget about war, bloodshed and misery they have been suffering for over the last four decades.
We are tired of war. We have one wish, that is to see calm and security in our country. We don't care about either the government or the Taliban, but we want an immediate silence of guns here.
So far, many regional and international players, mainly the US, have declared their full readiness to support any move toward bringing peace to the country.
This comes as many here believe the Afghan peace process has now turned into a good pretext for some local and international players. This is because such a matter allows them to further interfere in Afghanistan's affairs and follow their own interests in this wounded land. Sayed Amin Olemi, Kabul.
The UK government is mulling over plans to put some travelers coming to England in so-called quarantine hotels amid concerns about new variants of the virus.
As we vaccinate more people, it becomes more and more important that we protect against any new variants coming in. Once you have that protection and you don't have new variants in the country, you should protect against them.
Despite the high death toll, case numbers in the UK are slowly falling thanks to the lockdown. But the government is facing mounting pressure over when the restrictions, among them school closures, will be eased. As for the rest of Europe, well, they're worried about an outbreak of the so-called British variant within their borders.
Different European countries have different measures in place, lockdowns, curfews, but with their healthcare systems under immense pressure, they may have to enforce even stricter measures soon.
But the restrictions of freedoms already in place are testing people's patience. In the Netherlands, at least 150 people arrested Monday during unrest and looting in towns and cities across the country over an 8 p.m. curfew.
Het heeft ook niks te maken wat we zagen met strijden voor de vrijheid. We nemen al deze maatregelen.
What we saw has nothing to do with fighting for freedom. We didn't take all these measures for fun. We did so because we are fighting against the virus, and it's the virus which is actually robbing our freedom.
While the UK heads towards its mid-February target of 15 million vaccinations, across the EU, growing frustration with the pace of immunization. Last week, AstraZeneca told the EU it was falling behind on its supply target because of production problems. The EU Commission, in charge of approving and procuring the jabs, isn't happy.
This new schedule is not acceptable to the European Union. The European Union has pre-financed the development of the vaccine and its production and wants to see the return.
The delays will make it harder for the EU to meet its plan to vaccinate 70% of its adult population by late summer, leading to a deepening of the crisis across the bloc. The UK and European Union have survived Brexit and the financial lockdown of 2008, but it remains to be seen if they will survive COVID-19. Saeed Pariza, London.
Iranian Minister Mohammad Javad Zarif made a stop in Moscow for talks with his Russian counterpart Sergei Lavrov on mutual and international issues. In a joint press conference, Zarif said Iran will take proper action whenever the United States lifts the sanctions to pave the way for its return to the 2015 nuclear deal.
What we have heard from the United States administration so far has mostly been in the form of words and announcements of its position. However, it is actions that we respond to.
For his part, Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov said Moscow and Iran share the same position on how to preserve the historic deal, adding that it was up to the United States to take the first steps by removing the sanctions.
Both we and Iran are deeply interested in a full return of signatory states to fulfilling their obligations under the accord.
The top Iranian diplomat said Trump's departure brought along special circumstances that required Tehran and Moscow to coordinate their positions in this regard.
Our focus today was on the Caucasus and the regional efforts for bringing peace and stability in the Caucasus, because I am right now engaged in a regional trip to countries in the Caucasus, plus Russia and Turkey. We also had a major discussion about global situation and how we can revive the nuclear deal.
With the election of Joseph Biden, hopes for a more balanced approach from Washington and a return to the nuclear deal have been revived.
If this happens, and we hope that we'll be able to achieve such a result, then of course the relations between Iran and the Russian Federation will benefit, since they will be removed from illegitimate, illegal unilateral sanctions, both from the United States and from a number of other countries.
Zarif arrived in Moscow after paying a visit to Azerbaijan, where he sat down with Azeri President Ilham Aliyev.
Iran and Russia said they are determined to expand mutual ties and continue cooperation in regional stability and international security. Marina Kartunova, Moscow.
Italy's Prime Minister Giuseppe Conte tendered his resignation, throwing Italy into a government crisis in the midst of a pandemic that has devastated the country. More than 85,000 lives have been lost to coronavirus as Italy's economy is falling deeper into chaos. After surviving two confidence votes last week, Conte has reportedly decided to quit because his executive risked being defeated in a vote over a contested report on the justice system in the Senate, where he no longer has an absolute majority.
President of the Republic Sergio Mattarella received this morning the President of the Council of Ministers Giuseppe Conte, who handed in the resignation of the government that he presides. The President of the Republic has decided to invite the government to remain in charge to handle the current affairs.
The government was plunged into crisis after former Prime Minister Matteo Renzi pulled his junior partner Italia Viva out of the ruling coalition on January 13. Renzi had withdrawn his support over issues including differences on the COVID-19 recovery plan and the handling of the coronavirus outbreak. Conte is now expected to seek a third mandate from the President of the Republic, Sergio Mattarella, to form a new executive with a broader coalition. Should he fail to do so, Mattarella may decide to bring in a new prime minister or call for snap elections.
I'm going to make this very simple. This political crisis will result in more interest to be paid by Rome on its public debt due to an increase of the spread between Italy and Germany's 10-year yields. Whoever becomes prime minister next will have to implement tough reforms, including slashing health and social spending, in order to access the resources allocated in the EU's recovery fund.
On Wednesday, Italy's head of state, Mattarella, is slated to start a round of formal consultations with party leaders and other institutional figures to see whether a new coalition can be formed.
It isn't certain where this political crisis will lead. What is certain is that not even the world's worst pandemic in a century has persuaded the Italian politicians to remain united to face an unprecedented health crisis together. After the collapse of 66 governments in just 75 years of democracy, the country's future is now in the hands of President Mattarella. Max Civili, Rome.
Streets were deserted, shops were closed, and businesses were abandoned in Indian-controlled Kashmir as India celebrated its 72nd Republic Day.
What is there for the people of Kashmir to celebrate? Our special status was stripped, and so were our rights. The promises that were made were just a show-off. Our jobs, our land, and our opportunities are on sale. So what should I celebrate?
Amid suspended internet services and heightened security arrangements, authorities have held the symbolic Republic Day parade in a highly secured sports stadium in the heart of Srinagar. Indian-controlled Kashmir came under India's absolute control after New Delhi stripped Kashmir of its special status in August 2019. Following the move, pro-freedom groups in the disputed region were detained so that any dissent against India's decision would be prevented.
The democratic values for which the India is advocating and India is calling in the world that it is the biggest democracy, they are not following it actually on ground. Democracy gives the right of dissent.
Although New Delhi says the revocation of Article 370 was to integrate Jammu and Kashmir into the rest of India for easier development and equal opportunity for the citizens, analysts say the reality on the ground is quite the opposite.
After revocation of Article 370, which was one of the articles of the Constitution of India, the government's attitude has been more aggressive and arrogant, not people-friendly. There is no democracy on ground. The democratic setup has been closed down and an authoritative setup has been put in, which is working with a dictatorial attitude, and the people are suffering.
By staying indoors on India's Republic Day, people of Kashmir have once again displayed their level of alienation. Analysts say India needs to take necessary steps and fulfill its promises in order to win their hearts. Shahana Bhatt, Indian administered Kashmir.
The cities are the most important human habitat in the modern era. They show the extent of civilization, social life, and the blossoming of the capabilities of the citizens. Today, that geographical boundaries do not exist thanks to the modern communication technologies, better urban management techniques can be identified through sharing global experiences. The municipality of Tehran has been a pioneer in hosting international events since 2014 and has brought together academic and executive elites in the field of urban management from all over the world to provide a forum for exchanging urban experiences. The fifth edition of the Tehran Golden Adobe Global Award was held at a time that the whole world is hit by the spread of the coronavirus.
Amid the corona pandemic, we were in touch with the mayors of many major cities of the world to share experiences. We informed them about the tough situation of Iran, where it is hit by the cruel sanctions on the one hand and the corona problems on the other hand. We used urban symbols like Azadi Square to sympathize with those struggling with the pandemic. Via video mapping, we were the first city to sympathize with those hit by the virus in China's Wuhan.
Some distinguished foreign guests who were present at the closing ceremony of Tehran Golden Adobe Award also touched upon the role of urban management at critical times.
We have to think that COVID has imposed new expectations but also new realities, and we have to look at capacities for a new digital age. And finally, it's not only about capacities, it's also about the agency, the institutions. So we have to look at how government and institutions operate in this context, and how we can look at more healthier, greener, and equitable policies.
At the end of the ceremony, Tehran's Global Award for Urban Management in different categories was handed to the best project in the cities, regions, and local communities worldwide.
Tehran Golden Adobe Award is a comprehensive, academic, non-profit initiative that specializes in international urban management research and exchange. However, due to the spread of the coronavirus, this edition focused on methods used by urban managers to cope with the pandemic. Human Abadi, Tehran.
Yet another effort to stop Saudi Arabia's devastating war in Yemen. This time, 24 British Parliament members have urged Foreign Secretary Dominic Raab to halt the country's arms sales to Riyadh. In a letter, they have underlined that up to £15 billion worth of UK-made arms have been sold to the Saudi regime since it launched a war on Yemen in 2015. The letter also cites a recent UN report on the situation in Yemen, adding that the war has already claimed 233,000 lives, while about 24 million Yemenis are in dire need of humanitarian assistance. Many political experts believe that the Saudi-led war is being perceived globally as unwarranted and genocidal.
The global perception now about the Yemen war, if nothing else, is that this was unwarranted and genocidal. I mean, there's no justification for it. And it was a Saudi assault, but orchestrated by UK and US military personnel. Officers were in the Saudi capital from the very beginning. And of course, all the weaponry that the Saudi military uses in this genocidal assault is U.S. and U.K. military hardware.
Since 2015, the Saudi-led bombing and blockade of Yemen have devastated much of the poor country's infrastructure, with the UN calling it the world's worst humanitarian crisis. Half of Yemen's population is now on the brink of famine, many of them children. The country has also experienced the world's worst cholera outbreak and now struggling with an alarming COVID-related death rate. From the onset of war, many international rights groups and activists have slammed the West in general and the United States, Britain, France, and Canada in particular for their support for the Saudi-led coalition. They have repeatedly called on these governments to suspend weapon sales to Riyadh and Abu Dhabi to avoid a humanitarian catastrophe in Yemen. In September, a UN experts group named Canada for the first time as the one perpetuating the conflict in Yemen by selling arms to Saudi Arabia. So far, international calls have fallen on deaf ears as not only Saudi Arabia continues with its bombing campaign and blockade of Yemen, but its Western backers too continue supplying the regime with lethal weapons. It seems that what matters to Western powers most is putting their profit out of arms exports to their repressive Arab regimes above human rights and the lives of millions of impoverished Yemenis.
The Democrat-led lower house of Congress has forced a second impeachment trial in the Senate for ex-President Donald Trump on charges of incitement of insurrection following the deadly protests inside Capitol Hill on January 6th. There is seemingly no chance that a supermajority two-thirds of the Senate, which is evenly split between both parties, will vote to convict Trump this time either. Recent polls show America is almost evenly split on if Trump deserves a conviction, meaning the trial will be yet another highly divisive political event.
I think Democrats are basically taking this opportunity to once and for all kind of like rally around that, like, this person is, like, you know, evil. He's bad for the system. This is a terrible president to send. They're really just trying to hammer down that you can't get away with this stuff. This, and the president in his own words really did, like, rile up these people to come to the Capitol and, you know, wreak havoc. It's more of, I think, what they're going towards is, like, you can't come here and touch us.
Analysts suggest that Democrats may be pushing the trial as a way to weaken the Republican Party by forcing Republicans to openly choose between pro-Trump and anti-Trump factions. Conservatives could be weakened by infighting for years. Trump remains incredibly popular among Republicans, but a conviction would forbid him from holding office and running for president in 2024. Given the record anger, disunity, and polarization, many wonder if a successful conviction could backfire and provoke even greater problems.
All it really does is creates a vacuum for another figurehead to kind of go in there and take control of this mob of quite literally fascist. This is like fascism in actual definition. And what this does is, you know, we know Trump is a con man. We know Trump was often like bumbling his way through things. He was kind of like, you know, a joke, a mockery of the system. This unfortunately creates a vacuum where someone more competent in terms of just, you know, oppression, repression, can take control of this vacuum that Trump is leaving behind.
New President Joe Biden is being criticized for allowing Congress to focus on a trial instead of creating legislation to cope with a raging pandemic and a once-in-a-century economic disaster. Many fear the controversial trial will eliminate willingness for bipartisanship in a Congress in which Democrats have only a very slim margin of control. That's a different agenda than Franklin Delano Roosevelt's first 100 days in 1933, when he rolled out 15 major pieces of legislation, which began the so-called New Deal and economic recovery. The trial will begin on February 8th and must dominate the proceedings of Congress until its conclusion weeks later. Rami Mazahari, Chicago.
IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaykum wa rahmatullah.
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
همه با وجود قده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم.
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel.
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی.
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
The big and overwhelming problems of American society.
This is part of a televised speech delivered on July 31st, 2020 by Ayatollah Khamenei, the supreme leader of the Islamic Revolution on the occasion of Eid al-Adha.
We should notice that the big problems that have engulfed our main enemy is the U.S. government and regime, are not comparable to ours. The behavior of their cruel police is another indication of managerial problems. These phenomena will destroy the current U.S. system. The reason is that it is a false system. The economic and political philosophy of the U.S. system is a fallacious one. However, wrong and fallacious philosophies do not show themselves in the space of 10 to 20 years. They will show themselves in the course of time, and in the present time they are indeed showing themselves. In sum, U.S. management is suffering from confusion and dizziness. Of course, as I said, they constantly speak here and there, but this only exists on the face of it. They speak for the sake of appearances, otherwise all of them have domestic problems, and all of them are concerned about their own future.
Your light and love, all I see, nothing more I'd ever want to need. My Lord, protect me from dishonor, grant me faith to be stronger.
In my opinion, the Americans are trying to find an enemy. They sometimes mention Iran and they sometimes mention China and Russia as their enemies. They want to fabricate an enemy. In my opinion, the US has no bigger enemy than its own people. In the present time, the biggest enemy of the US regime are the American people themselves. They should not look elsewhere for an enemy, and it is the same enemy which will bring that regime to its knees. The US problem with us is that it can neither eliminate us nor make us surrender. It is trying to make us give in to its demands or eliminate and destroy us, but it cannot do neither of the two.
Alhamdulillah, alhamdulillah, all praises to Allah, all praises to Allah. Alhamdulillah, alhamdulillah, all praises to Allah, all praises to
Iran today.
The world is going on to 100 million coronavirus cases with about 55 million recoveries. There have been over 2 million deaths. Iran is one of the hard-hit spots on the globe with 10 cities in the red. However, its toll has been reduced to a fraction of what it was. As of 25th January 2021, there were 1.37 million registered COVID-positive cases in Iran. Of these, there were 1.16 million recoveries and 57,294 deaths. U.S. sanctions and a strained economy have meant less than average fiscal space and therefore a partially haphazard set of restrictive protocols in place. It's a wonder how Iran has managed to bring its coronavirus death toll down to a fraction of what it was. That's from 400-500 deaths a day to 70-80 plus deaths a day. Now, why and how has Iran set itself on this steep path to survival is our question. Iran has even attempted manufacturing an anti-corona vaccine, or let's say vaccines. More to follow. Stay with me, Leila Faramarzi, on Iran Today. More than 8 Iranian companies and universities are currently working on a COVID-19 vaccine. And Iran launched human trials of a first domestic COVID-19 vaccine candidate of its own late in December. But vaccine production or administering is not the primarily important step in corona control. Dr. Abul Ghassemi, Dean of Baghiatullah University, explains.
Controlling the disease and breaking the virus transmission chain is the most important task we can do to take the outbreak under control, which has several requirements that must be met. The most significant of which is that people observe social distancing, using face masks, and adhering to public health guidelines. Thankfully, measures have been taken in the country in the past few months that have raised awareness amongst the people, and as a result, the new wave of the disease was brought under control.
I said earlier that restrictive measures had been haphazard. Well, that doesn't hold for all waves of the pandemic, which is why Iran finally got results. Dr. Ghani is a lung specialist involved with the Corona Combat Unit and bringing vaccines to fruition. Iran's past protocols in controlling the spread of the coronavirus. What would you say are the strengths and weaknesses of those protocols?
We passed the first and second waves by issuing lockdowns and preventing people from going outside their homes. But we acted smartly during the third wave by dividing cities into different zones and imposing travel restrictions based on the condition in that specific city. We monitored people's cell phones, enabling us to prevent those who had contracted the disease from traveling. The airports are now being checked, and we have been increasing the number of coronavirus tests to several thousands. Our testing capacity was dramatically increased. The combination of these measures, namely early detection, isolation, and intelligent quarantines, helped us to rein in the disease.
Iran established a National Electronic Health Record, EHR, system in which every citizen is registered with a national ID number. That helped health networks start early detection of infected cases. Afflicted citizens could thereby be isolated. The most vulnerable were prevented from referring to hospitals in cities. Rather, health teams were assigned to visit patients at home. As for prevention, impoverished suburban residents reportedly had masks distributed to them. Dr. Mardani, a specialist from Mehr, a most prominent hospital in Tehran, joined us on Skype. Do listen in.
We were able to control the disease in the country. Fortunately, the number of the cases is now very low. The number of new patients has actually reduced to a third or a quarter of what it used to be. Our hospitalization have dropped dramatically. We have closed many COVID-19 wards in university hospitals and those belonging to the Ministry of Health and the Army. Our ICUs, which had no empty beds to receive COVID cases, are now accepting other patients. However, some hospitals still house coronavirus-positive patients.
Iran is one of the top 5 manufacturers of coronavirus antigen-based rapid detection kits in the world. And it's rapidly established a decentralized laboratory testing for COVID-19. The homegrown antibody rapid test can detect coronavirus in 15 to 20 minutes with over 85% detection power, which is higher than PCR tests. This country has a strong primary healthcare system, and with a production surge in a reasonable time and a multi-sectoral response to the corona crisis, it has achieved some impressive results which it hopes to sustain. On the 14th of January, Iran's COVID-19 daily death toll was reported at 81, marking a two-digit figure for 2 weeks and the lowest fatality rate in 7 months. To move on to what the future holds in store, the vaccine that is, Shafa Farmed has already cleared animal trials for its vaccine, and it aims to complete limited tests on 56 volunteers in its initial stage. Tests expected to last a month. How does Iran's success rate rank in combating the coronavirus compared to regional states?
There are two countries that are producing vaccines in the region. One is Iran and the other Egypt. But if you have a look at the UNICEF website, Iran is the only name mentioned as a producer of COVID-19 vaccines. The country that didn't want to have a vaccine is now producing it itself. The other point is that we in the biotechnology development headquarters have supported all forms of vaccines to be developed. So we will have a variety of vaccines in the coming months, God willing.
Here's a list of the most prominent vaccines currently being made around the globe. In the top three, you see US's Pfizer vaccine and the UK's Oxford AstraZeneca, which Iran found no use for. Not even for the 150,000 Pfizer shots the U.S. wanted to donate to this country. Several reasons why. Let's hear it from Dr. Abolghasemi. His Bariatollah complex is making a vaccine of its own and treats corona patients by crisis doctors with experience in war zones.
There is a drug right now called cyclophosphamide. This drug also happens to be produced by Pfizer. You cannot find the vial of the drug in Iran. I wonder how Pfizer, which failed to provide us with cyclophosphamide because of the US sanctions, has become kind enough to give us the vaccine as a gift. This proves they're politicizing the matter. That is, they first put pressure on a nation and refuse to provide it with food and medicine, and then give out a gift to whitewash their crimes. We should not be fooled by these things. We have been accustomed to this behavior for years.
Moderna and Pfizer vaccines were never on the agenda to be purchased by Iran anyway. This is due to their high prices, transportation problems, and the need to be kept extremely cold. This is according to Mohammad Reza Zafarghandi, head of the Iranian Medical Council. Iran deems its homemade vaccine to be more reliable than many foreign-made vaccines, but it takes a long time to be approved. So this country plans to import some 2 million doses of COVID-19 vaccines from India, China, and Russia by the end of the current Iranian calendar year, beginning March the 21st.
We on the vaccine committee know that vaccines and drugs are produced differently. When buying a vaccine, you must ask the manufacturing country to produce it for your country specifically. It is not like you go on and take the vaccine from the market. Each country has its specific vaccine and with its own production number. You cannot get this vaccine from anywhere else. It is specific to that country. What the leader of the Islamic Revolution has said in his remarks was that we don't trust Britain and the United States in what they will produce when you place an order. This is a bigger issue and has nothing to do with the types of vaccines.
More than 60,000 people signed up for the Shafa-Farmet trial vaccines mid to late December. Several other Iranian vaccines are expected to clear animal trials by late February.
The vaccine that Bariatollah University of Medical Sciences worked on is a recombinant type. We hope that it will reach the human trial phase by March. We are now in the animal phase. The vaccine has been tested on monkeys and given very good results. It was previously tested on small animals such as mice, which also had very promising results. We hope to be able to successfully prepare the vaccine and pass the human trial phase.
Faring in the meantime, I leave to after a quick media review. So let's move indoors to see what other media outlets have to say.